Welcome to Understanding Disordered Eating, episode 120. We are shaking things up a little bit this week as almost a tester and getting rid of our intro because it was getting kind of boring. So I'm Rachel Heinemann. I'm a licensed mental health counselor, a licensed professional counselor, depending on what state you're in, and a certified eating disorder specialist. Today's episode, we're talking about the difference between disordered eating and an eating disorder. But before we get into the actual topic, if you are looking for a way to bring the ideas that we talk about on this podcast into your personal life, make sure to head on to the show notes or to the website and grab your copy of the free journal prompts that will help you think a little bit more deeply about what's going on with your relationship with food and get to the next layer of the function of your relationship with food. Now, today's episode comes from a question that I get all the time from all different kinds of people. So people struggling, clinicians, family members, people just interested on what's the difference between disordered eating and an eating disorder. And I think that it's just interesting to note the terms disordered eating kind of sounds pretty bad. Your eating is disordered. It's just the vocabulary that we've come to use. I don't love it, but I just use it because it's what everyone uses, but it's not the best term. So the first thing that I'll say is, before I answer the question, I want to challenge the question even being there. So what's the difference? If we don't actually know the difference between disordered eating and an eating disorder, does it actually make that much of a difference in our practical lives? So for example, if I'm talking to a clinician and they're saying, well, I don't know if this person has disordered eating or an eating disorder, I would say, what would be the difference if you knew? And if the answer is, well, then we'd know what kind of treatment this person needs, what level of care, if they even need treatment. To that, I would say anybody sitting in front of you who has some sort of relationship with food issues and they're wanting help, they get it. And if they can benefit from a higher level of care, even if they don't necessarily fit into an eating disorder box, they go to a higher level of care. I think that when we narrow ourselves into boxes and say, this needs to be labeled as disordered eating or an eating disorder, we pigeonhole ourselves, we pigeonhole our clients and their recovery or self-growth healing journey. So I think that it's a valid question if we're trying to understand what each one is, but when the difference becomes significant because of what do we do about treatment, I would say scrap the whole question. Look at the person sitting in front of you. If they want help, if they need help. Now, if the question is coming from a personal place, like, I don't know, do I have an eating disorder? Do I have disordered eating? I would kind of say something similar where, what would it mean to you if you had an eating disorder, especially as opposed to just having disordered eating? Does the diagnosis itself scare you? Is there something practical that seems like you don't want that label? In which case, why? If it has anything to do with treatment, I would say labels irrelevant in terms of treatment. Everybody deserves help based on what they need and what they're wanting. So label doesn't necessarily matter per se. Maybe if you're trying to think about what diagnostic code to put on someone's insurance form, yeah, I guess it matters. But if it isn't clear to you, I don't think that there is a really big significance in trying to tease out what the difference between disordered eating and an eating disorder is. Obviously, I'm doing this for a reason because I do think that there is significance in defining what each of them are, less so differentiating where that gray zone is of what the difference is between them. So the way that I like to see relationship with food is on a continuum. So on one side, I know you can't visualize exactly based on what I'm doing with my hands here, but hopefully you can visualize just based on the audio. On the one hand, there's healthy eating, so just a healthy relationship with food. And on the other hand is really serious eating disorder. In the middle is this entire continuum of, on the healthier side of the relationship with food, starts as mild disordered eating, and as it continues, morphs into eating disorder, and then as it continues, morphs into critical eating disorder, medical complications, etc. Now, on this continuum, if we kind of think about it as, you know, when there's like a rainbow sort of thing or a hot, cold sort of thing, there are various points on the continuum that are ombre, or they're just sort of like colors bleeding into other colors, which means that there is no point where the red turns to blue or whatever color we're dealing with, where the disordered eating turns to eating disorder. It's a gray zone of when it sort of is headed in that direction. And here's the things that differentiate where on the continuum someone falls. Number one, the most important thing to think about is the severity of someone's symptoms. So when we think about restricting or binging or purging or exercise or body image or any of that stuff that has to do with eating disorders, there can be all different levels of each symptom. So let's just say restriction. On the more, quote, mild side of restriction, we could have just the typical dieter who's, quote, watching what they're eating, which I don't want to pathologize what may be every single person's relationship with food in this culture, but a diet is a level of restriction. I say diet in lieu of saying restrictive diet. On the other hand, with somebody with a pretty serious eating disorder, the restriction could be so restrictive where they're cutting out meals and snacks left and right for days and months and years on end. And it's very clear that, you know, just eating dinner is restrictive. But in between that, there's all different levels of severity. And that is where you would sort of see slide that toggle. Is that a word? I think I made that up. It's the thing in my mind. It's the thing that you sort of move all the way to the end or move all the way back to the other end. And the level of severity determines where the piece lands. We can use the same for binging. If somebody feels kind of out of control around their food and they feel like they have this emotional eating going on, that might be some form of a binge or even a subjective binge. And maybe there's somebody who is having an objectively large amount of food multiple times a day, feels completely chaotic, has all the symptoms of a, quote, clinical binge. And there is no doubt in anyone's mind that this is a very, very large amount of food. That can be the most serious form of a binge, but doesn't mean that somebody else's version of a, quote, binge isn't a binge. It's just maybe less severe on the continuum if we're thinking about disordered eating versus an eating disorder. I also want to emphasize that it doesn't mean that one is more valid than the other. Severe is not a synonym. I'm not using it interchangeably with valid. I think that if anybody is struggling with their relationship with food, whether it's just dieting or having poor body image or emotional eating, whatever you want to call it, it is a valid issue and it deserves help. We're just thinking here about severity of symptoms. How critical is it to get this person help yesterday? All right. The next piece to think about is the impact on functioning. So we can have somebody with a raging eating disorder, and this happens very often, really type A, you know who I'm talking to, that they're sort of like OCD anxiety keeps them from kind of falling apart on the outside. This is all visually based on what other people see. So this person might have a really good job and is climbing the ranks at work and really, really performing well and has a family and has friends and all these things are they're thriving at life, apparently, on the outside, thriving on in life. And then there might be somebody who has so much anxiety around food that they do not hang out with people. They don't leave their apartment anymore. They have trouble keeping a job, which means that they're not really functioning in life very well. So I'm not saying that the person who has this prestigious job and everything on the outside is totally doing fine. I'm saying that the impact on their ability to engage with life is different from somebody who can't get out of bed, who can't leave their apartment, who has so much anxiety going to any sort of social function. And again, one is not more valid than the other. It's just descriptions of where this person's relationship with food is. And I would sort of push it to more eating disorder if it's impacting their functioning in significant ways. The next piece to think about is someone's subjective experience. This is the kind of thing that if it's you, ask yourself. If it's your clients, ask your clients. This is going to be a really, really important question because even if the DSM gods are saying eating disorders look this way, a really important question that we neglect to emphasize is someone's subjective experience and someone's level of distress and preoccupation with their relationship with food. So let's take body image, for example. Somebody might have poor body image. They look in the mirror, they get dressed, they maybe find 7 outfits and they finally find something that feels decent. They're not that thrilled, but they go out and they forget about it. And they're like, eh, that sucks. Now, somebody else who has poor body image might be so distressed by it, they might not be able to leave the house. They might only wear baggy sweatshirts. They might vow to starve the next 3 days and go to workouts 2 times a day for however long and maybe follow through. That level of distress, the impact of the body image, what it makes a person feel and do is really, really important. Well, you know, let me take out the do actually. This is more so just your emotional feelings. The level of distress that, say, in this example, the body image causes you is really, really significant. Are you able to put it on the back burner and do what you have to do or even have a good time? Or is that kind of impossible where you're preoccupied with it all the time and you really can't get it out of your head? The preoccupation with food and you know, all things weight related or body image related is an interesting one, because this is a little bit of what came first, the chicken or the egg, because, you know, the level of obsession that happens in someone's mind is usually directly related with starving or being really hungry. So if you think about the biological nature of our brains, it's going to fixate on something that we need. So with food, when we're hungry, we fixate on food. And think about this, even if you have the most healthy relationship with food, this is actually the point. You start getting interested in food. Maybe you're more interested in food magazines as opposed to the architecture magazines. Maybe you're looking at recipes. Maybe you're talking about it with your friends and you're dreaming about it. And then once you eat, or as you eat, food becomes less interesting. The level of preoccupation around food goes down once you're not hungry anymore. Your brain says, "Oh, we got what we needed." End it. End preoccupation. Somebody who is chronically malnourished or chronically hungry will be obsessed with food. So a lot of people with eating disorders talk about the obsessions with food. This is actually one thing that with the GLP-1s, people talk about, like, this, it was so freeing. I didn't have to obsess over food. And it's like, well, there's actually a biological response to hunger. When you're not feeding yourself enough, yeah, you're going to obsess and this medication takes it away. That's for another time. But the idea is that the obsession is actually a healthy mechanism for our functioning and our survival. So, you know, the question is the obsession part of the eating disorder or is it a consequence of the eating disorder? But the idea is, how distressing is this level of preoccupation? Is this level of obsession? Is this level of distress to the particular person? And that's going to decide where on the continuum they lie. If this is something where, you know, somebody who's a really big insert diet fan, or they're very into wellness, whatever that means, their typical diet person, and they're fine with it. Or maybe, I guess this is going to be, you have to ask yourself if you're actually fine with it. But let's just say they actually are fine with it. Okay, fine. So they think about it sometimes, they don't think about it other times, moving on. Versus somebody who might be doing very similar things and it is impacting them in a very different way. That, I think, is a really, really big difference between disordered eating and an eating disorder. And often it happens where, you know, kids go on a diet together. Let's say high school kids go on a diet together and some kids are just able to just be like, "All right, that was a great run. Let's move on." And some kids, it really, really impacts them. And then it sort of like is the beginning of this raging eating disorder because of the subjective experience that people have when they're restricting. So that's going to be really individualized and really subjective. I think when we think about this gray zone and the continuum, we have to insert different levels of care onto the gray zone. So when we think about there's inpatient and residential and PHP and IOP and then outpatient, that is also on a continuum. So it's not like a let's connect the dots in a very linear way. This let's connect the dots in a maybe a different way for each person. So the IOP might technically line up with the continuum in a certain spot, but that's not going to be the same for every person. So thinking about levels of care as a continuum and relationship with food, so disordered eating versus eating disorder as a continuum. And again, emphasizing, what is the question behind the question? What makes you interested and want to know the difference between disordered eating versus an eating disorder? And how will that answer actually answer your question that's behind the question? And if not, what is this really about?
You made it to the end. Thank you for listening.
Every single one of your downloads means so much to me. If this conversation is leaving you wanting more, be sure to sign up for my newsletter. You'll have the opportunity to reply back directly to me over there. Can't wait to see you in your inbox.